This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. If you can hear it in my voice, I have lots of energy for today's episode.
Oh, energy. I'm guessing that's a hint. So what kind of problem are we solving today?
How can we hold the sun in a donut?
How can we hold the sun in a donut? Oh, this is a really great question. I can't wait to know the answer. Who is our guest today?
Today, we're going to get the answer to that really cool question from Dr. Arturo Dominguez, who is the head of science education at, get this, the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory.
Oh, that's so cool. Welcome to the show, Dr. Arturo.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer and Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are so excited because, as Jeff says, we get to talk about the biggest source of energy that we care about here on the Earth, the sun. So let's start with the basics. Like, what is the sun made of? What is plasma?
That's a great question, Jennifer. Yes, you said it. It's plasma. Plasma is the fourth state of matter. When you have very cold matter, you have a solid state. Then you have liquid if you heat it up. Then you have a gas if you heat that up.
And three.
And then if you heat gas up enough, it becomes a new state of matter called plasma.
Oh.
Okay. And so you were just saying that's what the sun is. Now, I teach science, so are you saying that everyone that's ever called the sun a ball of fire is not actually accurate?
They are accurate-ish, because fire is a plasma. The ones that aren't accurate is when they say a hot ball of gas. That's the one that I say, oh, no. That's actually is a hot ball of plasma. But you did point out fire. Actually, fire is one type of plasma. So the stars are a type of plasma, fire is a type of plasma, and there's several others.
Ah, I bet we're going to get to some more of them. All right. I like clearing up those things because when people talk science, facts really do matter.
Yeah.
So we should be saying things the correct way.
Okay. So I know that the sun is really, really, really hot. In fact, you probably know how hot it is. But fire is also a plasma. So how does fire get hot enough to become a plasma here on Earth?
Fire is, we hit on one of the controversial plasmas. Fire is the big cold. Some people actually argue if fire is a plasma or it isn't. So I would say, let's go to some of the ones that are definitely plasma. For example, a fluorescent light bulb or a neon sign. That's the type of plasma. When you look inside a fluorescent light bulb, it just looks like gas until you put a big voltage, a big source of energy across the sides, and it becomes a plasma inside. That's a plasma. Let's look at some other ones. For example, if you go out at night very far north or very far south and you look up at the sky, you see these majestic light shows, greens and blues. That's a plasma. Those are called the auroras, aurora borealis, or northern lights. And actually, southern lights, do you all know what the southern auroras are called?
No, I do not.
Jeff is thinking.
I'm trying.
I don't know.
Aurora borealis and aurora. Nope, not coming to me.
Australis. This is another one. Yes. So you do, if you go very far south, you can also see the auroras. Yeah.
Okay. So talking about plasma, I know we've jumped straight into different types of plasma, et cetera, but you are a PhD in plasma physics.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen? Were you just fascinated by neon signs or like That sounds like, to me, that sounds like one of those things where you not only better be the smartest kid in this class, you better be the smartest kid in a lot of classes.
So the cool thing about plasmas is that there's so many types of plasmas that are studied, you know, in astrophysics, in actually the ones that like low temperature plasmas, which are the ones that are like neon signs or the way you work materials. There's a lot of material processing that uses plasmas. So just to say, there's different pathways into plasmas. The one that I took is actually closely related to the sun and the stars, and it's fusion energy. That's the one. That's what really got me excited in the field of plasma physics, and why I decided to pursue a doctorate was to study fusion and how I could help create a star on Earth.
That is a great lead into the next question. What is fusion? Can you explain it to us?
Yes. So fusion is what happens in all of the stars, including the sun. It's when very small nuclei of atoms, the very center of atoms, when they collide and combine together to form bigger nuclei, right? So when that happens, and you're talking about very small atoms like hydrogen or helium, when these small atoms combine, they release energy in that reaction. And that's the energy that powers all of the stars and the sun, right? So when we're talking about the energy of the stars, it's actually fusion energy. And the idea is to try to do that same reaction in an energy-producing device here on Earth. That's the holy grail of
yes,
the holy grail of the research that we're doing.
Okay, so is nuclear fusion, is that the strongest source of energy that humans know about so far?
Yeah, so nuclear is, I would say, instead of strongest, I would say the most efficient, the most bang for your buck. I'm saying nuclear because people usually think of nuclear, they think of fission, right?
Right.
The breaking apart of nuclei. And that's like what happens in a nuclear reactor when you think nuclear reactor. That's right. The type of nuclear reaction that happens. Or in a submarine, right? You can have a very small amount of fission fuel in a submarine and have the submarine run for a very, very long time. Right?
Oh, wow.
That, you know,
right.
That's nuclear. Right,
right, right. Yeah.
Nuclear energy has a lot of bang for its buck. Fusion is the flip side of fission, right? We combine smaller nuclei and make bigger ones, but still producing energy. It turns out if you look at the periodic table, as long as you're creating reactions that go towards iron, you produce energy. So you either have a very big one that breaks apart and produces energy, or very small ones that come together producing energy up until iron. Iron's the most stable one.
I don't know if that was too much information.
No, that's so cool.
Well, so my background is chemistry. A long time ago, I have a bachelor's degree in chemistry. So I'm very familiar with the periodic table. Also did a chemistry book. So I did not know that. That is really cool about... I mean, I guess I knew iron was stable, but I didn't realize
the most stable one is iron. Yeah. The most stable nucleus is iron. And anything going towards there releases energy. Yep.
Okay. So I have to ask, because I'm sure there's people that are listening. So we know that when there's nuclear fission, we have side products, you know, byproducts, whatever you want to call them, that you have all this radioactive material that people don't know what to do with. Do you have that with fission or no?
With fusion?
With fusion. Yeah.
Right. The answer is no. There are no long-term radioactive byproducts. Take into account that I did say long-term radioactive. When you look at things like cesium and plutonium, those are thousands of years of radioactivity.
Yep.
One of the fuels that we use is tritium. Tritium is a type of hydrogen. And that one is short-term radioactive. It has a half-life of like 12 years. So there is radioactivity in the process, but it's very different. It's a very small amount of gas that you have at the same time. So you don't need any of these long-term radioactive repositories because you just don't have that amount of radioactive products and for that long a time. It's a subtle answer, but it's very different than the thousands of years of radioactivity from the fission byproducts.
Reactors, yeah.
Yep. Okay. I want to back up just a little bit because yes. a few things ago, because we've already jumped into a bunch of different stuff, a few comments
ago. Welcome to talking to me. When somebody talks to me, it's all
us,
over the
us too. We're the same way.
So this is going to be quite the little trio we've got going here. But you said that you were working on making a star here on Earth.
Right.
Can you go back to that and explain that for our listeners?
Yes, yes. Thanks for keeping us on track, Jeff.
First time for everything.
The idea is we are in the process from different, you know, different research centers and different areas of fusion research of trying to reproduce that reaction here on Earth in a way that produces energy. So obviously, one of the things that you need is for more energy to come out of the reaction than the energy that you put in.
Right.
And I say this because in the lab, every day, we produce fusion. We have fusion reactions happening in our lab in these containers that we'll get to. But we heat up the fuel hot enough so that every once in a while, the nuclei of the fuel gets close enough together to produce energy, right?
Wow.
But we've never gotten to the point that we produce more energy out than the energy that you put in. It's the minimum requirement for an energy producing device, right?
Right.
We've never gotten to that. But we definitely created fusion reactions in our lab. We do it every day. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I didn't even know that you could do that.
Yes. Yeah.
And the fact that you're doing that every day, that just sounds like a routine thing in your job. And I'm like, the only
way
I'm
saving energy today
is I flip the switch on the wall and I hope it works. But how do you know that you are creating the same amount of energy as an output as you are in?
Right. So again, we've never done that before, but we keep track, of course, of how much energy is going into the system by measuring how much electricity is going into it and knowing the way that you heat it in. We very carefully measure how much energy goes into the system. And then you can figure out how much energy comes out by the products of the fusion reaction. The main product that you can detect is neutrons. That's where most of the energy is going to come from. And you have detectors around these machines that can detect the neutrons and give you a sense of how hot it is and how dense it is. So the idea is to heat up the fuel to be very hot, very dense, so that the fusion reactions start occurring and then you can detect these fusion reactions.
Okay.
That's the idea.
That makes sense.
We just last week, one of the big fusion devices in the world, the Jet Tokamak in England, came out with a press conference stating that they've reached a record amount of fusion energy out.
Wow.
59 megajoules of fusion energy in this recent campaign that they had. So this is a field that's constantly in motion and setting new records. We celebrated with them.
That's a huge accomplishment. But now I want to talk about the containers because you were saying this is going to be really hot. What do we have on the Earth that doesn't melt when you're holding this kind of
thing? That is an excellent question, Jennifer. Yes. So not only do we have to get it really hot, we have to get it really, really hot. The center of the sun is 10, 15 million degrees, something like that. It turns out we need to heat the plasma up 10 times hotter than that, to about 150 million degrees, in order to have reactions that are that sweet spot at which you are producing a lot of energy out more than you put it. And we do that. We actually get to those temperatures in these machines that look like donuts. Donut-shaped machines. And these are, you know, metal machines that are empty on the inside, but like the Krispy Kreme outer layer is made out of metal, right?
And then there's nothing inside.
Well, you put some deuterium, some hydrogen in these devices, and you heat it up for it to become plasma, and up to the point that it's 10 times hotter than the center of the sun. And that's when you start getting a lot, you know, the most out of your reactions, right, at around those temperatures.
Okay.
Now, I must say, on a regular basis, most machines around the world don't get to those high levels. But even the machine, what one would call a smaller machine, the one that we run at our lab, still gets routinely to about the temperature in the center of the sun. So
that's, oh my gosh.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
That's crazy.
But I still haven't answered the question. How do we not melt the wall?
Yes.
Right? Yes.
And the answer lies in one of the examples of plasmas that we talked about, these auroras. Mm-hmm. The auroras we just mentioned, you can only really see them in the North and the South Pole, but right. not really. Here in Jersey, we don't really see them.
We don't see them in Florida.
Or Colorado.
Definitely don't see them in Florida and neither in Colorado. And the reason is because the Earth is like a big magnet. Right?
Right.
So the right. Earth has a North Pole and a South Pole and magnetic fields that go really far out into space
right.
and go back into the sun. So we said that the sun is made out of plasmas, and every once in a while, the sun has these plasma burps, right? They're called
yes.
coronal mass ejections.
Sure.
And actually, they were in the news recently because a coronal mass ejection just
took out satellites. Is that where you're going?
Took out a few satellites.
Yes.
Yeah. Took out a bunch of Starlink had just launched. That cost some money, didn't it?
Yeah. This is actually a big field of plasma research is to try to diagnose those solar storms just because of that, because they can cost a lot of money.
Wow.
And they can be detrimental to astronauts that are out in space.
Yes.
Right? So it's very important to understand these things. So the plasma, sometimes the plasma comes towards us, right? And when they reach the magnetic fields, what ends up happening is that the plasma gets stuck on the magnetic fields and starts spiraling around the magnetic field, but moving freely along it, right?
Okay.
So it has a hard time jumping from magnetic field to magnetic field, but it can freely move along the magnetic field. So when it moves along the magnetic field and comes towards the North Pole or the South Pole, it interacts with the atmosphere and creates those shows, those light shows that are the auroras. Right?
I did not know that. That is so cool.
Yeah. But the magnetic field shields us from this plasma, which can be very detrimental to us at those high energies. It shields us from the plasmas. And, you know, the only thing that you get is at the very north and the very south. The takeaway is when plasma interacts with magnetic fields, it gets stuck on the field lines and moves freely along it. Yeah?
Okay.
Okay. Is that why your container is shaped like a donut?
Yes. So if you think of the donut and you think of like the jelly inside the donut.
Yes.
Think of magnetic fields biting their own tail, right?
Then
the plasma is stuck in the like central axis of the donut, but doesn't touch the Krispy Kreme outer layer, right? That's the idea.
What a great way to describe that.
Yeah.
Perfect sense.
Right. And if you think about it, if you had a ball, you couldn't do that. There's no way to put magnetic fields that all touch their own without having like some infinite spiral in the middle, right? So you really have that donut shape. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So we just talked about how you, and I don't know how you're not like, your head must be enormous since you're controlling plasma at your job on a daily basis and you're making it do what you want it to. What is it that you are using to get it up to 100 million or 150 million degrees? Because I have a coworker who plugs in a heating lamp because she's cold in the office. And I think it gets to like 78. I don't know what you got.
Okay. Yes, that's an excellent question, right? So how do we heat it up? First of all, remember that we're only putting in milligrams of gas. So if we're able to efficiently couple a lot of energy into that very little gas, we can heat it up a lot. Okay. So that's the first step. So we just have to efficiently couple that. There are three main ways to do this. One is what's called a transformer. So this isn't like a robot. If you have alternate current, right, you can couple energy through the air by having a primary and a secondary. It turns out that you can do that and use the plasma as a secondary, and you couple a lot of energy, an external solenoid, to the plasma itself. And the second way that we do it is bombarding the plasma with very energetic neutral particles, right? It's kind of like the analogy that we usually use is like playing pool, where you have the cue ball that very energetically hits all the other ones, and okay. It transfers the kinetic energy to all the other ones. That's what you have to keep in mind. You very energetically accelerate particles into the bulk of the plasma and transfer the energy to that, right? That's the second one.
Okay.
And then the third one is kind of like how you microwave a burrito.
What great ways to describe.
You send electromagnetic waves into the plasma and let it resonate with the plasma. So whereas in a microwave, microwaves resonate with water particles of your burrito.
Yes.
In the type of waves that we use, which are longer wavelength, lower frequency, they resonate with the electrons and ions that are gyrating around the magnetic field. So you send it at just the right frequency so that you're resonating with the ions and the electrons and transferring the energy into your bulk of your plasma. So those are the three main ways.
Wow. Okay. So how long can you maintain this? Can you keep this for like 3 hours, 3 days?
Again, this goes back to this record that was in this last campaign. Fusion relevant plasmas, really hot plasmas, they've been able to maintain it for the order of seconds, you know, when they're at the conditions that they're generating a large amount of plasma.
Right.
There are some devices that use superconducting coils that have been able to confine plasmas that are not as energetic for longer, for hours even.
Wow.
So you can keep it for a long time. Really, when you're getting to those lengths and to fusion-relevant plasmas, what you really have to worry about is that some stuff starts leaking towards, some of the hot plasma starts leaking towards the walls, and then you've got to make sure that your walls can handle the leaked plasma that goes towards it. But it is of that order. You keep it for many seconds at the moment, or for seconds at the moment, and then you're expected to be able to maintain it for longer pulses in the future. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I can understand that.
Yeah.
So in your work, where are you in the grand scheme of, wow, fusion energy would be great to have, and me, Mr. Jeff, plugging into my fusion reactor at home to have all the energy I want for video games? Where are you in that process with your work?
The question that you just asked is something that we as a community have been trying to pin down, especially recently, right? So this is a very active question. When are we going to be able to have energy in the grid? So let's go by steps. So we've never been able to have an experiment that creates more energy out than energy you put in, right?
Okay.
So there's two big devices. There's several devices working on trying to get to that point. One is a very international collaboration called ITER, being built in the south of France, that the US is a part of. And it's expected for that machine to be operational within the next 5 years.
Wow. Okay.
Five, 6 years. And then getting to the conditions of what's called break even, the same amount of energy out than
right.
About 10 years after that, in 2035.
Okay.
That's where we're supposed to be getting there. Private companies in the US are pursuing a more aggressive timeline that gets us to break even by the end of the 20s. In particular, there's this company called Commonwealth Fusion Systems coming out of MIT that is currently building the machine that's supposed to get us there by the end of the decade of same, you know, more energy out than it, right?
Right.
But again, this isn't electricity. You asked the question, when can I turn on the light?
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
Now let's think of fusion of these 150 million degree machines as boilers, right? If you think of them like that, which is ultimately what they're going to be, the energy that's coming out of the neutrons has to be converted somehow into electricity.
Right.
And the way it has to be done, or the current thinking, is that it's going to hit a molten lithium lead blanket. So I'm like a liquid metal, when you think of the Krispy Kreme outer layer.
Yes.
Imagine that being made out of liquid metal.
Coating on it. Okay.
Yeah.
being heated up by the neutrons, and then that hot metal transferring its heat to water or to helium, something that will turn into steam or hot gas and turn turbines somewhere.
Turbines, yep.
That's where we're going to get to, right? That whole extra part, that this whole, what we call the neutronics, because it has to do with the neutron hitting it.
Right.
That has not been developed yet. There are groups all around the country and around the world working on getting the technology there. But when we're talking about a fusion pilot plant, which is where we want to get to, you know, something that creates, that turns on a light bulb somewhere. We are in the US, we want to be building it by the early 2040s. And then globally, there's the thought that we would want before the middle of the century to be creating these pilot plants. So that's where we're looking at.
So theoretically, so, you know, we have fission plants around the country in the US and around the world. So could you equate how much energy you think might come out of a fusion plant to what's being produced now?
Yes, it'll be very similar to it. The idea is that these plants could be, one would say it's a gigawatt size plant, which is that size. It's about the energy output of a fission plant. So exactly, what you're describing is called a base load energy source, which is it's a lot of energy density at once. And so you can use it to power a city or power factories, something like that.
Right.
It's of the same order of that. Yes.
Okay.
And the idea would be to have fusion plants and other alternative energy sources replace the hydrocarbon ones, the coal and the natural gas and all of that, so that we can cut back on the carbon emissions, which is ultimately what we're trying to do, trying to create a clean energy source for future demand.
That's where I was going to go with this. So if it's fusion, then you don't have all the radioactive materials, which we already talked about. But are there any drawbacks to fusion other than the very limited, like you said, hydrogen radioactivity potentially?
Oh, right. So the the short-term radioactivity. Yes, definitely. The main drawback is that it's super hard.
And expensive, I would imagine, at the moment. Yes.
It's not expensive because we just haven't been able to do it. I mean, yes, there's a lot of R&D going into it. But the estimates is that once you have it, it's not going to be a very expensive source of electricity. Really, what you need is water and lithium. And you need very little lithium in terms of energy density. I think the estimate is that if you have, so you need lithium because you can produce tritium, which is the type of hydrogen that you need for it from lithium. But if you think of it as water, seawater and lithium, the amount of seawater that you would need and lithium that you would need for an average American consumer for their whole lifetime is about a bathtub full of seawater and the lithium in my computer for the whole lifetime.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so efficient. That's the efficiency. If you have a 1 gigawatt plant for a year, if it's coal powered, you need about 30,000 rail car trains of coal to power for a year.
Wow.
If you were if you were to replace that by a fusion plant, you would need about a pickup truck full of deuterium and tritium. That's it.
Oh my goodness.
That sounds very clean and very efficient. So get to work on this, right?
That's beyond orders of magnitude. That's unbelievable.
That's the beauty of nuclear. Nuclear is so efficient. Yeah.
Yes.
Listeners, I wish you guys could see Dr. Arturo right now. This is the guy we want working on this problem because he looks so excited about being the guy that's working on this. We have a lot of listeners that are kids. We are talking about huge concepts right now, but you're breaking them down into Krispy Kreme easiness for our listeners to understand. How might a listener know as they're growing up that they might want to get into plasma and studying the sun and physics and energy? How might they know?
The beauty about the field, about fusion energy, the fusion energy field, is that there's so many challenges that still need to be worked out, so many skill sets that are needed. So if you're interested in STEM, if you're interested in different fields of engineering or science, there are a lot of problems and skill sets that are still needed. If you like materials, if you like physics, if you like chemistry, if you like the math side, if you're good with computers and like to code, there's a lot of challenges for you there. If you're good with your hands and like to work on circuits, there are challenges in fusion that you can work on, right?
Okay.
But let me give you another thing. If you're an entrepreneur, if you like to start businesses, there are businesses that are related to fusion that needed to be worked on. If you're interested in regulation, you know, if you're interested in regulatory work.
Yes, because there's going to be regulated. You know that.
Plenty of jobs there as well. And I just have to say, before we end up finishing this one, I've got to get it into the episode. Listeners, it sounds like if you ever want a job where your boss cannot make you bring work home, I think this one may be for you, because I do not believe Dr. Arturo has one of these donut machines in his second bedroom at the house, raising it to 150 million degrees.
I don't, but I can share with your listeners a link of how you from home can control a plasma yourself, actually. A plasma in the lab that you can connect to and control yourself.
We will definitely put that on the website. Make sure everybody goes there and checks that out. Yep. But we could talk about nuclear fusion all day, but I'm curious, do you have a challenge for our young listeners related to what you talked about?
Yes. So we started our conversation talking about plasmas, right? And we said that, you know, that the sun and the auroras are plasma. We also talked about fluorescent light bulbs and neon signs and flames, plasma TVs, some that we didn't mention, plasma TVs are a type of plasma. So my challenge for the listeners is to take a selfie with a plasma.
I like it.
Yeah.
Go out, maybe go outside during the day and take a selfie with a plasma. Or maybe somewhere in your house you have a plasma you'd like to take a selfie with. Or maybe just take a picture of it. Either way, we'd like you to...
Yeah, and then we ask you guys to share it with us. You can tag us on our social media and we'll make sure that Dr. Arturo sees this, because I'm sure he loves to see examples of plasma out in the world. This has been a fabulous conversation. I have learned so much. I don't know about you, Jeff.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being on Solve It for Kids, Dr. Arturo.
Thank you, Dr. Arturo.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thanks, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my. And now I have even more energy than when we started. Wasn't that a fun conversation? That took us into the sun, bringing the sun back to Earth hundreds of millions of degrees. Jen, I am just fired up.
But also, I have two words for you. Mind blown, right? I mean,
truth.
I think it is so unbelievably incredible that we can do stuff like this now. And yes, it's not fully functioning the way everybody wants it to function yet, but give it time. Humans are incredible beings. And the fact that we can even consider trying to harness the sun's energy here on Earth, it's just amazing.
It really is. And now I fully understand why Dr. Arturo is the head of science education where he is, because to link it to having the power of sun in a donut, what a great explanation. So, listeners, be sure, we want everybody doing this selfie challenge. This is a really cool selfie challenge because, A, you're going to have to go back and re-listen to this episode to find out some of the examples of plasma. But I am also interested to find out if anyone is going to get us a selfie with plasma in a way that Dr. Arturo didn't mention, Jen.
Oh, that is a great challenge. And if you do that, listeners, make sure that you tag us on our social media, which is @KidsSolve. We are at Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And don't forget to check out our website, solveitforkids.com, where we're going to have that really cool plasma video that Dr. Arturo was telling us about.
That's right. And be ready for our next episode on
Solve It for Kids.